bird. I think it's very nice to have such a mixture of very different backgrounds, this primary geospatial cultural backgrounds. What I'm going to try to do is to give you a little bit of an overview of the study of science by scientific means. So how can you use the scientific approach to understand better how the structure of science looks like, how the structure evolves, how we all are contributing to the structure. And of course, this kind of research is driven out of very large-scale data sets, such as the English-speaking Wikipedia part, which I just zoomed around before I went over to the slides. I would like to point out that Alex Peng and I, we actually had an almost identical title for our presentations. As you have seen, he has a much more kind of hands-on, expertise-driven approach to it, which I find very, very valuable. Whereas we take on huge dumps of data and we interlink data of different types, papers, patents, grants, news, etc. I think both approaches are very useful for understanding better how science actually operates. And I always think it's very important to have not only a large-scale map of all of science, but also to be able to zoom in to high-resolution inserts such as those which the Institute of the Future and many of you are actually creating. I think there's an interplay between those different quantitative and qualitative approaches. I wanted to open this slideshow with a kind of bird's eye view of our world. I didn't put the blue planet up here, but I basically give you the world population. I assume you're familiar with these kind of graphs. It's also interesting to look at the highest density boxes, which appear in Mumbai and Calcutta and Shanghai, at least in 2005. Night on Earth, in contrast to this, so these are the urban areas. And it's very interesting to actually take the same base reference system and to kind of switch back and forth and see commonalities and differences. This is IP address ownership as a kind of crude proxy for technological advances and advancement and sophistication in the different countries. Note that there are very faint large circles. This is done for a book, and they would be very much larger in this book, and 300 dpi. Here I don't get anything close to 300 dpi, as you know. So you might not see everything on here. But this large one circle is actually MIT right there, which holds an entire class A subnet equating to 16 million IP addresses. I don't think they are using this all right now. So if you need some, go there. US, Japan, and Great Britain holding the most IP addresses right now. And again, it's a crude proxy for what else you also might count as technological sophistication. This now you can compare the scientific productivity according to Thomson Scientific ISI databases, first author allocation only. So the affiliation of the first author is counted here. And again, it's very interesting to go back and forth in those graphs and to see where mankind's knowledge, according to Thomson Scientific's databases, is produced today. And this might change very, very rapidly. As you know, China is very clever in using all the money it makes by selling us all kinds of products, probably everything I own here, and putting it into research among others. So I have just welcomed a new Chinese PhD student in our center, and she's fully financed for 2 years, and apparently there are many, many like her which are now coming to very different countries to learn. And I think that's a great investment into the future, which China is doing there. I very much enjoyed the quotes which the speakers so far provided, so I thought I should add some of my, not my own, but some which I find very valuable. You see here Herman G. Wells in the World Brain. He pointed out that human history becomes more and more a race between education and catastrophe. He, around 1938, was very, very concerned that there would be a Second World War. And he personally went around and from many doors, from many academies of sciences, trying to argue and make possible that the best brains on this planet connect and try to avoid a Second World War with scientific means, with political means, with their own reputation, try to avoid such a bad situation. He thought that if you connect the top 1 to 2% of the brightest minds on this planet, that this would help. A little bit later, in the 60s, Buckminster Fuller, he thought this is not enough. What you actually have to do is to reach every single person on this planet and to increase all of our knowledge to a level so that we can create sustainable and also livable environments for ourselves. And so he invented this world game, which some of you might be familiar with. And the playing of the world game was intended to make the world work for 100% of humanity, not only for the rich and famous and those which are happen to be born in richer countries, 100% of humanity in the shortest possible time, so spontaneous cooperation without ecological damage or disadvantage to anyone. And I think this is still something we should all try to aspire to. I don't think we are at all there yet. I believe making scholarly knowledge, not only papers, but also data and software and news and expertise, also foremost maybe, available to anyone is very, very important. The next slide is this slide, which Paul already had up here, except here, X-Archive is not highlighted in red, but Wikipedia is. It was interesting for me to get this graph. So I contacted all the different data providers and tried to get their data, or we read it in a painful undergrad-driven process out of the web. Basically, as you know, the Royal Society data came into existence in 1665. So whoever subsumes this data set, including JSTOR, they are going to go back in time, which is neat for our kind of research. So if you want to study science, you want to go backwards as much as you can. And in fact, we are collaborating with the historians of science to also get access to letter correspondences. We collaborate with Colin Allen at Indiana University, where I come from, to also mine relationships between philosophers of science and to see their impact into the different sciences. The more you can go backwards in time, the more you can also potentially predict the future. So it's very interesting for us to see how far back certain data sets go. And the graph is organized in a way that you have, of course, time going here. And the number of papers or Wikipedia entries or preprints submitted per year is the y-axis. Over here, it becomes very interesting. You see the huge impact of the two world wars on scientific publications. There are these huge dips. And Derek de Solla Price has previously generated these kind of graphs. We wanted to overlay those graphs onto his graphs, but unfortunately, the holder of the copyrights, which I'm not going to name, they did not allow for this. It would actually have been very interesting to have Derek de Solla Price's graphs in here and then extends in both ways. What is maybe very also important for me is this little box up there, which is enlarged here. And again, I apologize, it's a graph, 300 dpi, large scale for a book. So the projector is, I don't know, 1,000 by 600 pixels or something like this is not going to do it all. But what you see here is that last year, for the first time, Scopus and ISI have the same amount of publications for this specific year. Scopus is still trying to catch up on the backloading of data. So if you compare, for instance, the Scopus graph with Medline, at least when we read the data, they haven't indexed all of Medline. I think in the meantime, they have all of Medline. You see also some of the other longer-term data sets, you have Physical Review going way back in time. And you see it's a huge increase in Wikipedia, which I find fascinating. So the question then becomes, how can you make use of all of what we collectively know? This is a huge gift we have, and if we cannot make use of it, we are basically doomed to reinvent the wheel again and again and again. The wheel now represents many of these things which we have already come to know. And if you look at what we do in a very normal, common sense, is that we use search engines to access everything we collectively know. And basically, search engines, if you want to use a metaphor, it's like charging a needle with a search query and poking it into this huge unknown size, unknown shape haystack. And even Google doesn't know how much there is out there because there's a deep web. There are many things they can't get to, etc. So you poke this needle into this haystack and you pull it out and you have this rank ordered list of hits on there, and then you try to look at the top N, depending on your time and desperateness. And this is what you do. You never know where this stuff came from, except you follow up local linkages. But you're basically crouching on the floor. So you find something, you do local search to other nearby linked areas. Or you just know, well, it comes from Stanford, Harvard, it must be good. But there are clever redirects now. And you never get actually to see what kind of coverage the databases have that you are querying. Where in this very large haystack these search results actually come from, you basically do not have an up button. So you can never lift up and look at everything. What we are trying to do is to facilitate this kind of looking up, going up, looking at the data set on the building, different data sets that exist, seeing the different qualities, different coverages, trying to understand patterns, trends, and outliers. And some of you might say, well, I don't have a need for patterns, trends, and outliers. All I need is facts. I need to know when this person was born. I need to know what the number of graduate students in my university is, etc. And I think for fact-finding, search engines work beautifully. But the moment you try to identify trends, patterns, outliers, general clusters of activity, bursts of efforts, etc., since search engines are not the best tool to use. So this is where data mining comes in, this is where network science comes in, and this is where also computational scientometrics comes in, and this is actually a term created by Lee Giles, the Scientia father, who said, well, there is scientometrics, there are about 300 people on this planet which study science using scientific means, using bibliometric, webometrics, infometrics, etc. And out of those 300, there are maybe now 20 which have access to more than a terabyte of data. How many of you work with more than a terabyte of data? I'm just curious to know this. How many of you program? All right, so you can master, can make those things work for you, yes. So what I'm going to do is to not go through all the formulas which are in those papers, and I have two of the reviews also downstairs hanging on the boards which come to see exhibit display in the hall. But instead of showing you formulas, I'm going to show you what we do for clients, and hopefully I can also give you an idea of how these scientometric studies, the computational scientometric studies, are typically conducted. Before I do this, I would like to point out it's not only advantageous for funding agencies to understand how science operates. It's not only good for researchers to understand how it operates and how we might be in a better position to see potential collaborators, to find funding opportunities, to get our words out to the people which would most benefit from it, etc. I think it also has advantages for industry, which are also in need to find access to major results and experts. I believe it would also be beneficial if industry would more cause an industry pull on some of the research conducted. Clearly, there still needs to be basic research. I think it has major advantages for publishers to actually have kind of more visual interfaces to their holdings, because it would ease the understanding of people of their coverage and quality, and also provide a more interesting or alternative interface to their data. And in general, for society, I believe it's important to understand what science is doing today, because they are financing it to a large degree. The general process of mapping science or generating a scientific study and result is that you go to a major database, and I should probably add now Scopus, so this is a 2003 review article from which this was taken. And a lot of things have happened in the meantime. It's actually quite interesting to see what we saw at the major data sets we had back then and what it is today. You might also add Google Scholar, etc. And you typically do this by a keyword-based search, or you have a number of key papers you cited, or major review articles, and you do a cited reference search. So you take this one key article, you get all the papers which cite it, all the papers that are cited by it, and you do this two rounds, and you end up with a quite sizable data set. You can then explore and analyze this data set and see what kind of keywords are in this data set, and then do a complementary keyword-based search. In many cases, you have to clean these search results. So you would look at the listing of all the journal names, for instance, and if there's something which is clearly out of what you're interested in, just take those out of your search result. It's still incredibly tricky to delineate new research. Take, for instance, network science, which I do a lot of research in. Almost all different sciences actually have, in some way or another, to deal with networks, be it ecological networks, biological networks, genomics, social networks, the internet, scholarly networks, you name it. How can you best get the best papers in this domain? And there are papers which I'm not going to have time to go into, which basically compare three different approaches to this. One is just having the entire database and then using this to delineate, cluster basically everything, and delineate this domain. The other one works on personal bibliography files collected from major experts in the different sciences. And the next one is actually an academy studies where they just queried major network science researchers and also asked them to identify us major network science researchers. And there are probably many, many other ones, other means to delineate a new domain. But this is a very interesting question in itself, how to get the right data set. The next part is that you have to identify the unit of analysis you're most interested in. Is it people? Typically, people are interested in people, so that's a good one. Is it major papers? Is it keywords? Is it major journals? Is it major institutions? Is it major countries? Is it bursts of activities you're most interested in? What unit of analysis would you be most interested to know about? If you have identified a unit, let's say papers, you have to identify what do you actually understand as a similarity between two papers. And again, there are different choices. You could say, well, two papers are similar if they're written by the same author, or if they cite each other, or if they're cited by a third paper, which is called co-citation, or if they both cite similar references, which is called bibliographic coupling, or if they share same keywords, which you do via text mining, and so on. So there are many different ways to do this. And then, in many cases, you also want to kind of reduce your data set because it's big. And the bigger it is, the more harder it will, the more longer the analysis will run, it will be harder to lay it out, etc. So a very normal thing to do is to just take those papers which have been cited at least one time, which cuts your data set in half, because half of the papers are probably non-cited. And so you have a smaller data set, and it might make a major difference if you started with a million papers and like 500,000 to worry about. Now, assuming you take CiteSeum and you now have 40,000, and you decided two papers are similar if they share the same terms. Now, in CiteSeum, at least 4 years ago, you had 40,000 unique terms times 600,000 papers. 400,000. All right, forget this now. All right. I should know this, I don't. It's, however, it is a very high dimensional space. In another example, which I will show you on the next slide, we took 1 year of the ISI Thomson Scientific database. So you have about 1 million papers, 1 million papers, and they are similarity to each other. It's high dimensional space. We, unfortunately, we as human beings are not really made for understanding these kind of very high dimensional spaces. So what you try to do is to take the space and to break it down to two dimensions. And you can see, well, my point two is a huge dimensionality reduction. At least try to go for three, and you can see three. It turns out that people love to be in 3D environments. I actually did a lot of virtual reality research in my life. But they are very bad at taking knowledge, information, wisdom out of source. So two is still the best we have, but this way you can also print it, you can send it off, you can have a huge group of experts sitting around a printout map and start annotating things. So two is actually pretty good. But you have this problem that you now try to preserve in this dimensionality reduction step, 1 million by 1 million to two dimensions. And these two dimensions are supposed to preserve everything of the nature, structure, and the data. And that is an issue. There are a number of techniques which are commonly used. As they are listed on the dimensionality reduction there. You might be familiar with multidimensional scaling. Doesn't really scale to a million. You might be familiar with latent semantic analysis. In the parallel version, it actually does scale. Topics model is very interesting as it gives you not only latent terms, but topics, so labels that you can use to later on label clusters, for instance. There are self-organizing maps which scale very well, etc. Oftentimes, you do not only want a two-dimensional space, but you also want to identify clusters of similar stuff, be it people, institutions, papers, keywords, whatever you deselected as your unit of analysis. And in many cases, you would like to interact with the space. You would like to zoom in and zoom out. You would like to query it, search for your own name, of course, your own name first. Then maybe look for other people you know, look for keywords you're familiar with, and kind of compare it with your own mental map. So here's the study which I mentioned before, where collaborators of mine, Kevin Boyack and Dick Clavens, have access to Thomson Scientific ISI data, and they use the combined Social Science Citation Index and Science Citation Index from 2002. 1 million paper, about 24 million references in 7,300 journals to create a comprehensive map of all of science. And I should point out that we have extensively tried to also do this in a text-based way, in a semantic analysis way, and it doesn't really seem to work because the different sciences really use words very differently, and in many cases they also have very different writing styles, very different ways to document and report their work. So what you see here is a map which was created based on the data I just mentioned, bibliographic coupling, so similarity in terms of references that these papers cite, was used as a similarity measure. So the more references two papers share, the more similar they are. It was then the bibliographic coupling counts were then aggregated at the journal level. Then an initial ordination using VXWatch, and a layout algorithm developed at Sandia National Labs was used to lay it out. Then spatial aggregation gave 671 clusters. And then these clusters were labeled by hand. And now this map is invariant to rotation and mirroring. So what you see here is a map which is rotated and mirrored in a way that mathematics is here. Most theoretical, most purest maybe, science is on the top. And then as you go down in clockwise direction in this ring of science, you have computer science, computer technology, you have physics, into chemistry, environmental sciences, geosciences, biology, microbiology, plant, animal, infectious diseases, over to virology, biomedical, the medical sciences. Brain into psychiatry, psychology, education, economics, with this interesting appendix into policy and law, and then statistics and up to math again. There's also this connection via physical chemistry, physics, vision into psychology, which is interesting. Typically, this is a ring. My collaborators, these two I just named, they have recently done a study where they compared more than eight maps of science generated on very different data sets, papers, journals, educational data, and also just expert maps generated by hand in the 1930s. And it seems to be that this ring shape of science exists in all these different maps, which is interesting. So it seems to be rather stable, even though, of course, the different areas are pulling and pushing on each other extensively. Now, if you have this base map, and there now exist more recent base maps, which actually fold in Scopus data, so this is not the recent base map. But if you take this one, then you can use it just like a map of the world. You can overlay other data. And so what was done is to overlay funding patterns. So here you see funding by the US Department of Energy. And the size of the circle represents the amount, and the colors, the recency of the amount, is lighter colors, more recent funding. And you can do this also for NSF. You kind of see what they fund, and you can do this for NIH. And you see how complementary NSF and NIH actually support the ring of science, if you wish. I wanted to show you some other sample science studies, then talk a little bit more about the exhibit which you see down there, and then tell you about the cyber infrastructures which we are developing to make it easy for many researchers, but hopefully also at some point for all the different users which I have listed in the beginning, to create their own map of science and to make their own sense of science. So again, people are interested in people. What you see here is a map of information visualization researchers. This map is based on data from one out of three conferences. This data happened to be in the ACM Digital Library, and this is what we used here. There are no books, no journals captured in this data set. So one out of three conferences. What you see are notes, which are labeled by the last name of the author. Linkages represent co-citation relationships. The size of the note corresponds to the area size corresponds to the number of papers published, and the note color corresponds to the number of citations received. We also colored notes according to so we also have a color coding here for the notes. The edge color represents when this co-authorship relationships fund was first established. So older co-authorship linkages are going to be orange, and the newer one will kind of spring green. You see that this is a data set which is animated over time. So you basically take the final, the total data set, you lay it out, and you fix the position of all nodes. And then for the first time slice, you just turn on those nodes which are already in existence, and those linkages which are in existence. And so on. What you see is the growth of different subnetworks, and it's interesting to see that they grow very differently. Stuart Cott, who is on the map, he was so kind to actually label this and share it with me. So this is Stuart Cott right here. He's one of the pioneers in information visualization. He, together with Robertson and McKinley, for the most part of this data set, all worked at Xerox PARC. So not much teaching duties, mostly research. And you see that it's very different pattern than somebody like Ben Schneiderman, who works with this incoming outgoing stream of students. And he is the one who is the only constant in the game, basically. You also see that the networks which are forming are still geospatially separated, like for instance, Wittenberg and CMU are not connected. CMU is connected by Stephen Eich, who also happened to co-author this Gershon and Card, a very interesting paper. Virginia Tech is by itself, and this huge clique up there, this was basically a multi-author paper. And so you can start looking at these dynamics of different fields and different research groups over time. And of course, some of the people with the big notes in here, they are printed it and they framed it and they gave it to their dean. That's another way of using it. I should also point out that in such a visualization, basically you want to have a larger, darker node. There are some nodes here which are rather large and rather yellowish. This might be due to the fact that they published very recently and therefore nobody had time to actually cite them. So you can always go back and actually see what the dynamics is. In general, this is also an exercise in telling and showing you that it's possible to not just attach one number to each of us, the pH index, for instance. But it is possible to look at our effort and at our success in certain areas of research from a more comprehensive, maybe not global, but rather localized scale. You could, of course, also do very localized maps of just Bentschneiderman, kind of on the individual level. And that would draw a different picture, because he does not only do information visualization, but also a lot in terms of HCI and recently creativity support tools, which is not much captured here. But then you can do kind of communities of science, and you can do all of computer science, for instance, which information visualization is a subfield of. And then you can do these global maps of science. And just like you don't look at the map of the world so often in your life, it's good to know that it exists somewhere and that we have it in our classrooms. But typically, you need the map of the town you're in to find this venue here, or to find the next baby shower, or to find the next kids' birthday, etc. So in many cases, local maps are much more useful than global maps, even though I find it still fascinating to, for instance, look at 113 years of physical review, how it cites each other, how far do people in 2009 go back in time and cite all the other little things. And this is a map, again, which is 30 by 24, 300 dpi, and I can't possibly reproduce it here with the projector we have today. It's part of the exhibit downstairs, and I was wondering, I might actually do a tour of the exhibit if there's sufficient interest. I don't know what time would be good, but it would have to be today, I've got tomorrow. We also look and try to answer questions such as, does space still matter in the internet age? Does one still have to study and work at MIT, Harvard, let's say, or Stanford, in order to have access to high-quality data and expertise and to produce high-quality research? Now, if you equate high-quality with citation counts, which is not perfectly okay, but some people do this, then it turns out that space totally still matters. And one reason for this is social networks. Social networks are much easier to maintain in, if you run actually into these people and have a chance to have a dinner or breakfast from time to time. And if you read things, then you might actually read today more because it's easier available to you. It's just a click away. But when it comes to deciding what goes into these 10 slots you have at the end of the paper, many people apparently consider whom they have to face again the next time that they walk across the hallway or go to the next conference. And that is an interesting psychological factor. We also look at bursts of activity. And again, I don't have a chance to go into all details here. This is written up in this special PNAS issue. So if you are interested, I can tell more at the question answering session. So maybe just make a note. But I think it's interesting to not only look at the structure today, but also to try to get hints to what might happen tomorrow. And there are approaches now, thanks to John Kleinberg and others, which allow you to do so. We are interested to not only look at scholarly data, but also at patent data. Here you have a study by one of my former students who looked into intellectual property claims. So as you know, patents basically tell, here, this is me, this is my space, don't infringe on me. And there are some people which try to make money with this, of so-called patent mills. And so we compared the patent holdings by Apple Computer with the holdings by Jerome Lemelson, and we tried to identify how much more new space people were trying to claim. And again, all these things are written up, and I have a pointer to those papers at the end of the slideshow. We started to map Indiana in a very extensive way. So thanks to my collaborators, we now have data from 200 different databases, also including all the PhD theses ever published at IU, all papers, all intellectual property, all patents, and huge data set. And it's very interesting to actually see, and again, this is a kind of geospatial local map. And this is something I care about. This is my university. And it's, for me, very interesting to see when the first woman came and actually what did she do and how hard was it, actually. And that's something very recent, actually. We try to also communicate to a broader audience how useful visualizations can be, because in many cases, science and nature, sorry, choose a nature presence here, they actually try to convince authors to take off legends from visualizations which then appear on the front cover pages. And as you might realize, many scientific graphs, drawings, depictions, they're basically almost useless if you take away the legend. People don't know anymore where the data came from, what was done to the data, what kind of tools were used to do it, what kind of who did it, which is oftentimes also an indicator for quality. And old map makers, they used to sign their maps. They were proudly signing those maps. So I think we have a lot of re-education to do to tell them, hey, it's not just ICANN. You can actually take information away. So what we did here was to take a complete English Wikipedia, and we just mapped this at these. And I wonder if there's time later on, I can show you a use of the space map. So you get a 6-foot diameter map. And what you can do is to turn on and off the results of different data analysis results. You can, for instance, highlight high degree nodes. You can highlight bursts of activity. You can highlight all articles by a certain bot or by a certain human being who identified him or herself, and so on. So it's another base map, just like the base map of the world, or the base map of science I have already shown you. What we also try to do is to serve this via GigaPen. So some of you have been in when I browsed and zoomed around there. We also have it on Google Maps. So you can serve these things in kind of digital worlds. But the problem is you can never see it all at once. So the print art still works the best for us. And it's kind of very weird, because I actually came to US because I was fascinated by 3D virtual environments. Until I realized, well, there are only so many cave systems on this planet. Cave is this 3D virtual reality room where you project onto walls and the floor and top, and potentially also behind you so that you even lose orientation where to get out of this thing again. But then you're in a 3D dimensional world. And that is cool because it's a very effective interface to our sensory system. And also haptic and audio and visual systems just merge. It's not like here where you don't use your paravision much, you type this thing. And then we saw, well, we want to build systems which are useful for more people. And so we did kind of Second Life environments, but back then with active world technology. And we did a lot in those environments. And it was very hard to educate people because it's so easy to go in there. In 2003, we held an entire conference on education in there, and we mapped the entire conference as a nice poster, seeing where all the conference attendees go over time and how they distribute themselves over space and how much one keynote managed to attract themselves. But then again, people didn't think that they could go in there. And then we started to do 2D interfaces. So we worked with Java, etc. But the quality of the screens we have right now and the projectors didn't do the trick for the amount of data we wanted to communicate. And then at some point, we started printing this stuff. And it was amazing how much people, which we were looking for, which paid for us, loved these results, and that's why I'm now always with a poster roll under my arm, because people really can relate to paper. It actually took a long time to invent paper, and it's still a very good medium, and people immediately start annotating and drawing on it. They can fold it up. You don't have to boot up. It's right there. You can hang it on a big wall. It's very interesting for me to go from these cool 3D environments paper, and
be so happy. You unfortunately obliterated the explanation with that picture of your mom. So how is it representing the information? Mm-hmm.
So here in this particular case, we took all the Wikipedia entries, and as you know, they are linking to each other. So we took those linkages as an indicator of similarity of two Wikipedia entries. And then we took the entire data set, fed it into the VXOR layered algorithm, which also laid out the map of science we saw before. And you get a two-dimensional layout. These are dot patterns. And you can then label those dots, which in this case had high editing activity, with the title of those Wikipedia pages. This basically is dots and labels. And we thought, wow, Wikipedia has so many images. Wouldn't it be neat to get some images on there? And so we started to grid the entire space. And then for each grid cell, we identified the article which was most linked to by other articles. And if it had an image which was not a logo, we placed it there. If and if it didn't have an image, we went to the second most highly linked to article, got the image from there, etc. And this way, you get these images on there. At the end, we had to decide if we want to censor it or not, because the most highly labeled or highly modified entries are actually Jesus and Adolf Hitler. And we then decided to make the poster available for mature audiences. And we just mapped the new damp, and George Bush is the highest edited note. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to tell more about it. Maybe just let me go quickly through this.
You provided the question, the answer to the question, what do Britney Spears and Albert Einstein have in common?
We also were interested to know in how far Wikipedia covers science, math, and technology. So here you see color codings. Again, apologies, these are the large map. The green, the blue dots are math. The green is science, and yellow is technology. Very same base map. And if you come to the tutorial room downstairs, the larger lecture room, you actually will see the large map, so you can look at it in detail. And apparently, Wikipedia does capture quite a bit of those three themes according to category labels which are associated with Wikipedia entries. And in the corners of this particular poster, you also see the same base map with overlays of article edit activity, number of major edits, and in degree, and also those activity. Okay, I will have to speed up a little bit to get to the cyber infrastructures. So as I mentioned, we can also serve different maps. This is a map of neuroscience abstracts submitted to the annual Monstrous Conference with 30,000-40,000 people attending and trying to communicate research to each other in 3 days. So you can serve this as a map, and our hope is that in one of the next conferences, we can actually have a 3x3 meter display of all the abstracts submitted to this particular conference, and then you would be able to use a V interface properly to punch in your name or punch in the sessions you're interested in, and then they would highlight it, and you could kind of get an idea of who is in the room, which I believe I still don't have, even though you're not 40,000, much less than 40,000, but still I have a hard time to understand what my audience currently is. I know 5, 6, 7 of you and the speakers. That's all I know. It's not perfect what we're doing right now. So again, you can zoom in, of course, and you can select different entities from there. Won't have time to do much on the science exhibit, so maybe I should do this later. But in general, it's a physical exhibit, and then there's the poster version, which you get to see downstairs. And then, of course, there's an online website. It's a 10-year, 10-iteration effort. Currently, we are in year 4 out of 10. Next year's iteration is on science maps for science policymakers, then science maps for scholars as visual interfaces to digital libraries, science maps for children, science forecasts. And the last one is how to live with science maps. Mm-hmm. I think this is a very important one. As part of this exhibit, you also have this illuminated diagram display, two large-scale maps printed, again, 300 dpi resolution, and you would use graphic projectors to illuminate light patterns on top of it. And these light patterns can then be used to, for instance, identify nanotechnology. So you click on the button of nanotechnology, a touch panel, and on the map of science and on the map of the world, Everybody who conducts nanotechnology according to ISI, terms of scientific data, is going to highlight. You can also select so-called people buttons. For instance, Albert Einstein, and in the first time slice, you would see all the works he has produced. In the second, the works that cite his works. And in the third, the works that cite citing works. So you see the spreading of his impact in science space and in geospatial space, if you wish. We also now have this in Chinese. We can't do anything anymore except DNA, I think, is still there. Only thing I can still read. It's actually on display at the Chinese Academies of Sciences right now. We are working on a multi-panel display for Tokyo, Japan next year. And so here again, you would be actually able to see zoom into different areas of science. Again, this is the world map, the scientific publication activity, and you can zoom in and look at this more closely. And of course, here I can only zoom to a certain degree given the graphs I took from the static image. And you can also look at science and again zoom into the, for instance, anorganic chemistry peninsula. We also started to do science maps for kids, hands-on science maps. This is kind of like the slide and sneak process where you have to put little animals because they are mommy and daddy animals. I don't know if you have done this. And here you would put major scientists and major inventions to their respective places on a map of the world or on a map of science. And then as soon as you're done, you turn it around and everything is messed up again and you start again over. The trick we did for getting this into the hands of children was to use the pure data. So this is, again, a low-resolution version of the large map. There you have the pure data, but then one of my students, she added watercolor paintings, trying to make it more tangible to children. And then these are the kind of puzzle pieces that you have to move around. And there's a cheat sheet because even some of the caregivers don't really know where certain inventions and inventors go. And this is inventions in the right places. It's interesting, if you open a book, a science book in US, you get all the US and American inventions, inventors mostly. You do this in Europe, you get all the European ones. I didn't open a Japanese one, but it's similar. So you really need global advisory boards here. We took those maps into school settings, and it's amazing how easily children take on this idea of science maps and researchers going over the different areas of science in their pursuit of knowledge and discovery. And we also, at the end, asked these first, second graders to find their place in science. There was this little girl which told, oh, I want to be a nuclear physicist. And I don't make this up because I'm not a physicist. And she put her little star in the right corner. And I think it's important for children to learn that they can have a place in science. And where does
it be? Are they sitting on a map?
They sit on a map of US, yeah. They sit on a physical large scale tapish carpet of the United States. We also have drawing exercises, and we have kids' drawing contests, which come with the physical exhibits of the mapping science exhibit. And they are winners. And actually, this is the best. Deal for spending $300 in prices. You get an entire town and all the children between 4 and 14 and their parents and their friends to think about what is my favorite scientist and my favorite science experiment. And all you need is $300. It's just this enormous value that you get back for little money. All right, let's go back to behind the scenes. And I know I have only 4 more minutes or so. So what we tried to do in order to make this type of research possible for more people is to get money and then to build a number of cyber infrastructures, which you see here. Maybe I go quickly over those. There is the scholarly database, which has right now provides access to 20 million records, papers, patents, grants. It basically tries to overcome these silos which exist. So typically, funding is not linked to papers, is not linked much to patents. And in particular, there are no databases which would allow you to query for one person and get all of his papers, patents, grants, and download it as a dump. And this is what you need for these kind of studies. So we put one in place, and it's evolving over time. We just put a new solar interface in it. So I know some of you registered yesterday, and you might have to wait another week until the new interface comes up. But it's way faster than what you had before, so you will like it. So you can, this is the search interface. You just select whatever data set you wanted there. You won't be able to select FISREF because we signed these wonderful pieces of paper, which basically restricts us for our own use. QNAS you won't see it, but you will see National Institute of Health, NSF, US Patents, and NADLINE right now. And we are folding in new data sets. These databases have different number of records, different yearly coverage, different updates, and again, some are unfortunately restricted access. You can do geospatial overlays. So this is just Google Map, an overlay of NIH grants. You can also do Medline publications. You can go back and forth and see if everybody who got money also produced publications. And some didn't, and they might have saved patients instead, patients' lives, which is a very good thing to do, I think. NSF grants. And again, you can, of course, slice and dice this now in different ways. This is all the US patents. In order to do these kind of layouts, we have another piece of infrastructure, which we call the Network Workbench, which is a collaboration with people like Laszlo Barabasi, which some of you might know, Alessandro Vespignani, Stanley Wasserman from the social sciences, Santiago Schnell, and then Eric Werner from our local IT group at Indiana University, very good IT support. And this Network Workbench is meant to serve network scientists in the study of networks, which might come from very different areas of science. And so here you can download this tool for all platforms which are currently common, including Macintosh, etc. And it gives you an interface where you can load data, you can run very different algorithms, which are on the next slide, and you can generate analysis and visualizations or simulate data according to the type of research you're used to. This is a listing of algorithms as of July 2008. We just put in a lot more scientometrics relevant algorithms. I have a new handout downstairs next to the exhibit. Game over, almost, yes. I should mention that in order to drive this infrastructure and also a new infrastructure for epidemics researchers, we developed something which might be interesting to some of you, namely an empty shell. And I would like to compare this empty shell with an empty Flickr YouTube. So if Flickr and YouTube wouldn't have any images or videos in it, it would be completely boring for anybody except all the computer science geeks. However, as soon as people start to add images and videos, etc., it's really, really interesting because now you have an easy way to share these materials. What we did for our own purposes is to build on OSGI, which is a major industry startup, and to add what we call a SciShell, Cyber Infrastructure Shell, which allows you then to easily share data sets and algorithms. And this is behind, or is at the core of the Network Workbench and of the new epidemics infrastructure. So researchers, not computer scientists, researchers, social scientists, physicists, biologists, they can now share data sets and algorithms not as easily yet as Flickr and YouTube videos, but almost as easily. So there are wizard template-driven processes to get your algorithms in there, be it in Fortran, C, or Java, or C++, and then we have a number of other ones which we support. And there are interfaces like the one on the previous slide, which you can use to then just run them in a kind of menu-driven way. This is more on OSGI, but maybe only interesting for those of you which are interested in empty shells. Mm-hmm. And again, there will be a new epidemics infrastructure, and that's it.
Okay. Thank you.